let's forget about how many people we can touch. Let's focus on how you, the Bitcoiner, who understands what Bitcoin is, how best are you doing it? Are you doing it in a way that you feel like this is the best way I can teach this person about Bitcoin? And I feel like once you do it good, it has a ripple effect. Then there's a network effect after that. So the person now goes and tell other people and stuff. So I'm just like laser focused on the next person I'm going to meet and tell them about the book, or just tell them about Bitcoin. Because the most important thing is not even about the book or maybe about the technology itself. It's about what that person is going through and how you can use Bitcoin to bring a solution to them.
All right, everybody, we are back here today with the one and only Zonda Fatsing, our first guest from Cameroon. Super excited to have him here. Zonda is the author of this book right here, a book for kids on Bitcoin called Bitcoin Kids. Helps to not only teach kids about Bitcoin, but also just more broadly financial literacy, money, etc. I met Zonda last week in Ghana. I think it was last week, almost a week and a half ago now, in Ghana at the African Bitcoin Conference. Instantly vibed with him. Super nice guy. Very easy to speak with. Kind-hearted. You know, in the Bitcoin space, people can be aggressive sometimes, but that's actually more true on Twitter than it is in real life. In real life, everybody is super nice to each other. So I'm going to let Zonda introduce himself, but I'm just going to give a quick preface. If you hear any sort of background noise, or maybe there's a little bit of an interruption as we're doing this podcast, you know, we've had a little bit of trouble getting this together, Zonda and I, because the internet hasn't been great on his end. And this is something I've been thinking a lot, having just returned home from Ghana. You know, if there's background noise or some technical audio issue, please bear with us. The infrastructure that we take for granted often in the United States, just having functional Wi-Fi or something like that, is not always the case in Ghana or in Africa at large. It's something to sort of be grateful for. So anything that doesn't maybe sound perfect on this call, maybe just accept it. It's not the biggest deal in the world. And I can guarantee you that Zonda's words and his message will resonate more deeply than just being happy about, you know, having some sort of quality audio or video or something like that. So let me leave it there. Zonda, please fill in any gaps that I missed about yourself. And yeah, please introduce yourself more broadly.
Hey guys. Thank you so much, Frank, for giving me the privilege, the opportunity to be on this call to share my experience once more. Something that I like to inspire newcomers into Bitcoin, to inspire kids, to inspire parents and everybody else that is interested in Bitcoin. Like you said, my name is Zonda. I'm based in Cameroon. Cameroon is a bilingual country, so most Cameroonians speak French and English, and I'm not different from that. And in Cameroon, sometimes we have like internet troubles, and it's rather unfortunate that yesterday and today has been one of those days that we having this trouble. But I think in the last 2 years, there's been like a lot of improvement in terms of the stability of the internet. That's why it permits us to people from this side of the world to really compete globally. Because in the last 4 years, I've been working remotely with international companies, and really little or no hassle. Yeah, just some days that are really bad. So yeah, that's pretty much me. And I'm ready to dive into the conversation and see who are going to inspire today.
Yeah. Let's start with a backdrop. Thank you for telling us about yourself. Please now fill us in a little bit about two things. One, about Cameroon in general, especially the financial economic situation. And two, about the fiat currency that you use, which is termed the CFA franc. There are, I believe, 14 countries in Africa that use the CFA franc. You are actually the first guest from one of those countries where it's used. There's a lot of controversy around this currency because France essentially controls the printing of it. So I'll drop it over there and I'll hand it off to you. So again, a little bit of background on Cameroon and a little bit of background on the CFA franc.
Yeah, so Cameroon is situated between West and Central Africa. So sometimes some people confuse Cameroon to be a West African country or a Central African country because of the geographical location. And Cameroon is divided into two. So there are 8 regions that speak French, and then there are 2 regions that speak English. So the country is a very bilingual country. Around now, the country is going through a civil war that is because of the language problem. So the people who speak English, feel marginalized by the people who speak French. So there's some sort of a civil war, internal squabble going on for some time now. And yeah, and Cameroon also is the head of all the CEMAC zone countries. So CEMAC is Central Economic Community of Central African States, right? So it's like a body that comes together every year. They're the ones that decide how much of fiat currency they'll print and put into circulation. And Cameroon embodies the headquarters of these countries. So these countries are Equatorial Guinea, Congo, Chad, Gabon, and Cameroon. So there are 6 of them, right? So, and then the headquarters is in Cameroon. So every year, the presidents of these nations come to Cameroon to decide what they're going to do with fiat currency, their economy, they decide budget and stuff like that. But all of this is being overseen by France. So there's nothing that really goes on without France. So you can see a meeting, you don't see any French people, but they must have obviously asked for their permission and stuff like that. So that's how it rolls. And Cameroon has, like, in the Central African region, Cameroon has I think the second largest population after Congo. We are about 27 million people. Yeah, and Cameroon has a very vibrant economy. So most people from Chad, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, they immigrate to Cameroon for greener pastures or something like that. Yeah, rather than the other way around. So within the context of CEMAC zone, Cameroon looks a bit economically advanced than the other countries. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, but when you compare with the other 17 14 French-speaking countries, I think Cote d'Ivoire is a bit ahead. Uh-huh. Cote d'Ivoire, then you have like Cameroon and stuff, then the others. So, but in general, in Africa, the worst performing economies are French-speaking countries. Yeah.
Please expand on that if you don't mind. Well, I know the reason for that based on what I've read, but I probably don't know the full reason. So for my sake and for the sake of the audience, please explain why that is the case.
Yeah, so because it goes way back to the policy of assimilation of France, right? Mm-hmm. So France has a way of indirectly controlling you. So you go out of yourself and you become French. So going out of yourself means you take away your culture, you take away your way of thinking, you take away everything that used to be something that you cherish and all of that. And then you become French. So anything you do as from that time on, you do it for French. And one thing that is very amazing about the policy of assimilation is it's almost invisible. So even right up till today, people are still performing the same thing, but they are not critical enough to know that this is what is going on. And even if you tell them, they will not accept. They will tell you, this is what is happening to my life. This is how I'm living my life. I don't have any problem. But that thing is going on. It is going on. It is going on. Until recently, there was this guy, I think he's called Kemi Seba, one French, he's French speaking from Africa. I don't really, maybe from Mali or Congo like that. And he's very outspoken about the French oppression and all and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And there's been like really good signs from Mali, from Burkina Faso, where now they have like new military leaders who are taking over power and are changing the narrative. They are telling kids in school, I watched the video like 2 days ago, the president, who is a military guy, I think he's like 39, he's from Burkina Faso, is telling kids that the white people, the French people most especially, have lied to us for too long. I mean, it is something I dreamt of while I was reading about history and stuff like that, because I've been very critical, like right from the time I just got like 16 or 17, because I kept getting worried, like, why is the CFR not compared to the dollar? Why is the CFR so low as compared to the dollar? isn't it just something that maybe people are saying that the dollar is like this because the dollar has maybe different things that it's being tied to?
Yeah.
It's just paper money. So I had this critical thinking right from way back. So but I was just trying to like figure it out until I found Bitcoin. Yeah.
I have to, before we get into finding Bitcoin, which is always, I love hearing people's story, I want to go back. You said two really, really important things. Generally speaking, yeah, you said most people don't understand the dynamics at play with their money. That I agree with 100%. And I agree with the second thing you said 110%, which is that even when you tell them, there's like a cognitive dissonance, like, no.
Yes.
That cannot exactly be the case. And what I've learned, I've been writing about this stuff in the space for 3 years, is when I say these things to people, I've watched people shut down emotionally when you start to describe these things. And someone put it best to me. Someone explained this to me. Someone very close to me said, it's not that they don't believe you, they're scared. It's when you explain exactly this to them, they're scared. Exactly. So they're doing something to protect themselves because they don't want to believe that this is true. That to me truly changed my life, because then you start realizing that what you and I are trying to do in terms of not just educating people about Bitcoin, but looking at the problems created, you know, that Bitcoin, we think Bitcoin solves. But if we were just to look at the problems, whether you agree with that Bitcoin solves them or not, trying to explain those problems to people is not purely a psychological or a cognitive thing. It is a very emotional thing. And I've only recently recognized those things. So please feel free to comment. But I just wanted to say that I completely relate to what you're saying on both fronts. And I think it's really important that you highlighted the second thing, that they just simply don't believe you when you start to explain these things to people. You have come up with a very, well, let's first start with how you came to Bitcoin, because it seemed like, based on what it says here on the back of your book, it says you sort of got it right away. And that's my story as well. Someone described what it was to me in January 2018. There was no like, oh, I don't believe this. I started studying it immediately. I was like, oh, that's an absolutely brilliant idea. So please let people know how you found Bitcoin and how quickly it clicked for you.
Yep. So one thing I always like to talk about the basement, because it depends on your basement and how you grew up and how your mind works determines how fast or slow you can understand Bitcoin, right? I'll speak about this later as I speak.
Yep.
So for me, I've always been very critical about and curious about new technology, about new stuff, about learning stuff and asking questions and stuff like that. So so I started my own business consultancy way back when I was like 19 and 18, wow, like that. And so I was going to school, but at the same time I was learning on YouTube. So after a while, school, I got fed up with school, then I continued learning from YouTube. So YouTube has been like my best teacher in the last maybe 13 or 14 years, I think. Through that, I got to learn a lot of stuff. You know, on YouTube, you can just search and then you just see some stuff on your feed and like that. So that's how I just got to learn a lot of stuff. And one thing I did after I read a particular book that really transformed my life is Think and Grow Rich.
Yep.
So Think and Grow Rich, one of my biggest lessons that I learned was creating a mastermind group. Mastermind group means that you guys are seeking for knowledge and then sharing knowledge to each other so you guys can become like really a formidable force. So I can be very good in searching about maybe technology. Some of these guys good in searching about maybe writing or whatever topic. So when we put this together, we become very strong. And back in 2017, I think like March, we fell on Bitcoin, and then everybody like did a research. So it was really easy for everybody to understand because we just picked out the most complex topics, and then we were just talking to each other, and we just got it right there. And 2 days later, all of us like put money together, invested in Bitcoin. But now one thing we missed is somebody cloned the Coinbase website at the time we wanted to invest at Coinbase. So somebody cloned the Coinbase website. Instead of putting O, instead of us reading the O, we read zero.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So you see red Coinbase, the same thing. We used that website. So it was after like a month and we're not seeing anything that we realized that we're being scammed, right? And you know, we put out at the time 2017 was like $1,000, right? And that was quite a bit of money at that time. And it had a toll on me, not because I was afraid of Bitcoin, but because of my environment. Now, what happens is, oh, what happened to your Bitcoin stuff? You got scammed. You know, this thing is a scam. You know. But in my head, personally, I know it's good stuff. I just made a mistake. Yeah. But my environment wouldn't let me express the other side, right? It became a bit difficult for me. And then cash wasn't something that you could easily get by, then put here, then make a mistake, and then get back, you know. So I had to, like, retreat for a while. I think, like, a year or two. So it was late 2019 that I said to myself, I wouldn't let people decide how I want to live, right? I wouldn't let how people think about me determine what my future looks
beautiful.
So I said, okay, what can I do? The best thing for you is to gain the knowledge. So you have lose money, now you have to get the knowledge. You don't have to make the same mistake. That's how I got to know about the Bitcoin Standard. Then I read 21 Lessons. Then I read Jeff Booth's book,
Price of Tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. And everything clicked. And that's how I became a true Bitcoiner. And what I did from that on, from that time on, the knowledge was too much. So I started like doing online webinars where I was teaching people about, and I forgot to mention that within the 2 years that I was out, I got into shitcoins as well. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you look at my past history, like some online, you see me talking somewhere about Ethereum and stuff, because I went down right up to the nitty-gritties of how to build smart contracts just to understand. Oh, wow. Because I made a mistake. Yeah. So, and then I was teaching people about this. Right. So, but at some point, after reading a lot about Bitcoin and stuff, I started like dishing out the whole other cryptos and stuff like that. And then just felt strictly into Bitcoin, and it was through my sharing of knowledge that I got to know about Paxful. Mm. So somebody recommended me to Paxful, that this guy could be a very good guy to like spread the Bitcoin knowledge in French Africa, and bam, I got the job.
Oh, right. You worked for Paxful? Yeah. I didn't even know that. Oh, yeah. Okay, nice.
Yeah. So I was senior marketing associate for Francophone Africa. Mm. Yeah. So I was using my past experience knowledge for after creating my digital marketing company, working as an engineer and stuff like that, and then brought all of that stuff into Paxful. And with my newfound passion for Bitcoin, everything just went like boof, right? So yeah, I had a really good time. I think it's been my best professional experience so far because one, I was doing something that I really liked. And two, I saw how transformational it was for the people that I was talking to. So every morning I was waking up and looking forward to do that job, right? So, yeah, and the people that I was working with, I met most of them for the first time in Ghana. Mm. So, yeah. So most of them are working now with either No One's or Fedi. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, to comment on a few things, to start with the latter part of what you said, there were so many smiles in Ghana. So many people had been communicating for maybe like a few years online, and it was the first time they met in person. So the feeling was very, I wrote about this recently in my newsletter. It was like a high. I felt like I don't drink or do drugs or anything. And I felt like I was like, woo, this is great. And then even meeting people like yourself who I hadn't engaged with online, who I was like, these are my people. This feels really good. That's amazing. That's really cool. Another thing that I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to have looked at the way Ethereum works. I think that some of the functionality of Ethereum will exist on second layers of Bitcoin. But I think that the big thing people get confused about is the Ethereum technology, which I find interesting, and Ethereum the asset, which is something that I would not store my wealth in. So I think the technology is interesting and it will be used. We use smart contracts on Lightning. Smart contracts are used on other parts of Bitcoin. But I think the idea is, especially when you see this Ethereum meme like ultrasound money, that's just a scam. I'm sorry. I'm not even saying that to stir the pot. It's that Ethereum does not have the qualities of money. Bitcoin is money. Ethereum has interesting technology, but it's not money. And I think that that's one of the things people need to differentiate. But I think inevitably some of the technology on Ethereum comes to layer twos on Bitcoin. So just to put it out there, no need to like apologize about it. I think it's actually good to have some knowledge of how Ethereum works. I just wouldn't recommend it as an investment. I think as a technology, it's interesting, but as an investment, it's not the way that I would invest at this point. We're not going to go too much farther down that. So given the work that you did with Paxful, you're communicating with people. So now you're learning what works in terms of communication, how to educate. And so you figured out how to do that. That worked for Paxful. And it also, I'm assuming some of that experience brought you to what informed this idea about writing a book. So with everybody in this space, I think depending on our personalities, our knowledge base, who we work with, we're always sort of finding out a way to best transmit our knowledge about Bitcoin to other people. I'm still refining that skill myself. So what did that process look like for you? And why did that end up turning into, why did you think to yourself, I'm going to put this knowledge into a children's book as your sort of, I would say, the primary thing that you're now known for in the space?
I think that too has a bit of a background history. I've had like a bunch of failed projects, right? And I've always been trying stuff. And I've been trying like lots and lots and lots of stuff. And I knew that once I get into Bitcoin, I need to do something. I need to create something of value, not just for myself, but something that can stay and stand the test of time, right? And I like to communicate. I like to talk to people. I like to write. And I understand Bitcoin. So I, with Paxful like was like a playing ground for me, like you said, to test how much people understand Bitcoin, their level of complexity, and their level of adoption, like resentment towards Bitcoin. So all of this, it was building like data in my head, because at one point, before starting writing the book, I was taking lessons on becoming a product manager, right? Yeah. So as I was talking to people, it was building data, sets of data in my head. Right, but nothing really clicked yet. I'm like, okay, I'm just gonna write a book, and there are so many books on Bitcoin. So, what's the new thing I can bring in this space that somebody will look at it as Bitcoin knowledge, but they'll say like, wow, this is easy for somebody to just pick up and then read and stuff. So I want something simple, but I didn't know what kind of simple thing I'm gonna create.
Yep.
Right, but one day I was just working on my computer, like I'm sitting right now, and then my son comes around. It's like 4 years old. And then he's a very curious guy. I think at the time he was 3, he asked me a question, because the Bitcoin logo was just somewhere on my screen. And they asked me like, what's that? He touched the screen and then said, what's that? And I'm like, this is Bitcoin. He said, what's Bitcoin? I said, digital money. Then he couldn't say digital money. So he just looked at me and then he left. So it was
okay.
Yeah. I felt like maybe somebody just sent me that, like, you need to go tell your dad to start working, right? So immediately he left, I just wrote on my notepad, Bitcoin Kids comic book, and that's it. Yes, that's it. So okay. Because of all the data that I have been building, and then I've been thinking of different ways to put it together. So as he came, I'm like, this is a kid. What if I do something for kids? What do kids like? Comic. What if I make it so simple that kids can understand? And then it is also good for adults who think that Bitcoin is complex and who are very reticent.
Yeah.
So that's the solution to start writing a book. And it gave me like confidence and market validation, because I have a testing ground. So what I did next was I took now the Bitcoin logo. I created a sticker of Bitcoin, because I put it around the house, and I was telling him like, this is Bitcoin, this is Bitcoin, this is Bitcoin, this is Bitcoin. So one thing I noticed that was amazing is when his friends came around, he would tell them, this is Bitcoin, this is Bitcoin, this is Bitcoin. That was very interesting to me, and I begin to like think about the characters of the book already, like how am I going to make the characters. So one thing about the characters, I wanted to show where I'm coming from, Africa, then like putting the culture in the mix, and then just tell people that Bitcoin can just really is Bitcoin is like water. It can just be anywhere, anytime, any place, regardless of who you are, the kind of person, where you're from and stuff like that.
Yep.
So if you look at like the characters in the book, everything is specifically African scenery, global south, right? Yep. And yeah, so all of that was like deliberately thought about, like meticulously, step by step, to pass out a message to people that Bitcoin is for everyone.
Perfect. And it is a perfect segue, actually. So you actually use a term that I really liked. I've seen the term post-colonial money. I think you referenced it as decolonized money. Yeah. So, exactly. So one of the things that one of the reasons I'm quite happy I traveled to Ghana and to El Salvador was because I had been reading about Bitcoin in the Global South for a while. Now, I used to live in the Global South, Ghana, Venezuela, Namibia, and I had traveled to other countries within it as well. So I understand philosophically why Bitcoin would be a good thing, because I understand and have seen with my own two eyes, especially in Venezuela, what currency debasement looks like. So I get it. I get how it would be a solution. What shocked me about my time, especially in El Salvador, was how few people care about Bitcoin. And I don't say that to be pessimistic, I say that to be realistic. Yeah. So you know this, I'm sure. There's, when people talk about this, they talk about it like it will just magically sort of like adopt itself amongst the population. I now know more than ever, I'm completely bullish on the people who have adopted it and how they feel and how it's changed their life. But I'm very realistic about the work that needs to be done to get it into people's hands, and especially the people that would benefit it the most, which tend to be people who don't have a lot of discretionary income. They don't have a ton of money to go and invest in Bitcoin. So I'm curious, two things. One, what do you really think will help broaden adoption in Africa? And I know education, but is that on a mass level? Is that doing the work one-to-one, combination of both? And then two, for people who don't have the discretionary income to sort of to invest in it, what are some of the ways you sort of advise people if they're looking to earn it, if they're just looking to earn it without having to spend their money on it?
Yeah, so I think that's a really great question. It's something I've been thinking about since I wrote the book, and then I've been having like lots of feedback. And I've come to realize that there's one thing that we all Bitcoiners need to understand. Bitcoin is not going to help everyone, right? There's really no solution in the world that is helping everyone.
Yep.
Even if it's created for everyone. So when I came to terms with that reality, I began to feel more better, because at first I was thinking, oh, these people don't get it. These people have to get it, you know? So once I got into that, I was like, okay, yeah. So what next? What can I do? Like you said, there's a lot of work that we need to do in order to make people understand the importance of saving the people that we can reach out to. Because I myself alone, somewhere in Cameroon, you somewhere in the US, and a few Bitcoiners, we cannot touch the rest of the maybe 7.5 billion people that need to understand what Bitcoin is. Right? We can only do what we can do, and we have to do it in the best way we can. So my focus is, how are you doing it? Are you doing it in the best way you can? Mm. So, yeah, let's forget about how many people we can touch. Let's focus on how you, the Bitcoiner, who understands what Bitcoin is, how best are you doing it? Are you doing it in a way that you feel like this is the best way I can teach this person about Bitcoin?
Yeah.
And I feel like once you do it good, it has a ripple effect. Then there's a network effect after that. So the person now goes and tell other people and stuff. So I'm just like laser focused on the next person I'm going to meet and tell them about the book, or just tell them about Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Because the most important thing is not even about the book or maybe about the technology itself. It's about what that person is going through and how you can use Bitcoin to bring a solution to them.
Yep.
And then we also have to come to a realization that even if you give them the solution, they will not accept it, because there's that problem of confirmation bias all the time.
Yep.
Right? Yeah, so there's a lot of things I've learned myself personally.
Yeah.
I think last year I was not like this. Yeah. The book has given me the opportunity to talk as many people as possible. Yeah. And I like had like lots of feedback. I have like really smart friends who are earning really good money, but they don't want to hear anything about Bitcoin. Yeah. But they like my post, they support me, they're like, oh, go, you know, right? So I have to come to terms with that. Even if I think that they have to be understanding Bitcoin, but I have to come to terms with that. So that's it. And on the flip side, there are people who want to listen to you. There are people who are willing to take action. So those are the people I'm focusing on.
Totally.
So if I can give my best to these people, I think and if everybody does the same, I think we'll be on a on the right side, on good track for adoption.
That's a beautiful way to put it, I think. And I actually wrote the same thing when I came back from El Salvador. I said, yes, you can look at maybe the 90% of El Salvadorans that don't care about Bitcoin at all. That's not what I prefer to look at. I prefer to look at the 10% that has adopted it and to look at how it's changed their lives, because eventually some other people might come around and they're going to look to other people. They're going to have to see the change in other people's lives for them to become believers in it. And then the other side of it is that if it's not your thing, it's just not your thing, and that's fine. That I really don't care at all. I'm not going to tell anyone what to do with their money. That's totally, totally fine. And I think what you start to learn is like, yes, whoever, someone said this to me actually, when I lived in Namibia, I had a friend there, and he said, we went to graduate school together here in New York. He came over on a scholarship, and we were good friends while he was here. And he said to me, if I could really share with you the key to being successful or happy is not trying to reach everybody. It's just simply sharing what you know and letting that resonate with whoever is going to find it. And I think that that's the same when it comes to this stuff. I used to think you know, we're watching currency debasement around the world. To me, the best way to hedge against that is Bitcoin. So I figured, okay, that would make sense that people adopt it. But again, once you really get into the nitty gritty here, when you understand people's psychology, people's emotions, all this kind of stuff, you're like, you know what? I don't want to push you. Like, it's a good idea in my opinion, but that's simply my opinion. And I see that more clear than ever now. Interesting. When you hear people who look, you said something really interesting to me. You read the piece I wrote for Bitcoin Magazine, and you said to me, like, you were, I think you said you were, in so many words, sort of nervous that I would just be reiterating the same sort of talking points people reiterate when it comes to Bitcoin in Africa. But then you said you were pleasantly surprised when you read it, and it was mostly focused on the voices of Africans, the people who I've interviewed now, like yourself, for this podcast. What is your normal response when you hear people who have never been to Africa talk about Bitcoin in Africa? How do you feel when you hear those sorts of talking points from maybe some of the bigger names in this space who don't really understand the reality on the ground?
I sort of have mixed feelings. You know, there's some things about, there are facts about Africa that's true. And then there are things that people just say because they want to say, and then you get the point. So sometimes I have, based on the specific thing they are saying, it triggers like maybe good or bad feeling. Mm. I'm like, oh yeah, what's he saying about Africa? That's okay. What are you saying about this? That's okay, right? So, and the thing that was really interesting about your article, and which I observed, you took time to talk to the people that are doing the work on the ground, then you transcribed it into an article.
That was it.
So you didn't add nor remove. Maybe you just made the comprehension of the article more eatable and stuff like that. And I like that kind of writing, right? It's either you come or you talk to someone who is doing the work. They give you the information that you need, right? And with the internet today, it's very easy. So sometimes when I get mad, I'm like, what does it cost this guy to just speak to some African Bitcoiner and ask them about what's happening on the ground? And if you want to make the information be more valuable, they'll do like just you did. You ask this guy. And then you put it together and then you come up with a sum, like an average of everything. I'm like, yeah, okay, this is the information. This is the right information and stuff. Or you travel by yourself. So for me, I usually have like mixed feelings. There are things that are true about Africa and there are things that you must come and like witness yourself, right? Yeah, but like for example, a lot of people feel like, I don't know if it's still the same thing. Most people just feel like in Africa, a lot of things don't just work. Maybe the internet, the road network, the way people sleep, what people eat, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, but there are things that either somebody who is living in Africa tells you, or you come to Africa and witness it for yourself.
Yeah, yeah. That was the main reason I started this. I'm inherently, my default way of approaching the world is a skeptic. I'm very skeptical of things. So when I see people, you know, talking about Bitcoin saving Africa, one, I hate the word saving. It sounds so paternalistic and silly. So one, that bothered me. But two, I don't know. I come from this world where I come from the world of DIY music. So I grew up in like the underground punk, hardcore, hip hop scenes in New York. And with a lot of that stuff, it was very sort of proof of work oriented. So you sort of knew who was putting in the work and who wasn't putting in the work, who was just posing. So my thoughts were like, okay, you know, I keep seeing this guy Oaken pop up, and I used to live in Namibia, so let me speak to this guy. I used to live in Ghana. I see this guy Kumi pop up on my Twitter feed. Let me speak to this guy. And I think some of the best stuff I've heard, it actually wasn't from Africa, but I interviewed Win Koko Aung from Myanmar. He writes for Bitcoin Magazine. He works with the HRF, the Human Rights Foundation. You know, I said to him, we talked about it, the realities of the ground of Bitcoin adoption in Myanmar, where it might actually help people. He's like, no, most people just aren't going to adopt it. They're going to spend their efforts learning another language so that they can become a tour guide, earn fiat, blah, blah, blah. And I don't get disheartened by that. I'm happy to hear the reality, because maybe there'll be a time that maybe some of their payment can be in Bitcoin and that helps them save, or maybe not. But I think more than anything, what we need always is sort of a sober view on things versus a hyped up view where it's like, this is going to fix this. The other side of it is that while I think Bitcoin in many ways can help Africa and people all over the globe, I don't believe it as a fix everything sort of thing. People still need to be people with each other. They need to be humans with each other. It's a tool. It's an amazing tool. It's a global tool. It's a tool that many people can access. And I think it's really, really important to look at it those ways. But I think what I've noticed, and this is a bit deep, and some people might get mad at my saying this. I think some people who look like me, white people from, you know, the States or Canada or Europe, feel in some sense maybe like they're absolved, like, oh, there's Bitcoin thinking, like, you know, like this will, you know, help countries that have, you know, people who have been colonized and have all this other stuff happen to them. But it's not that simple. You know, I think it's far more complex than that. So when I go to either El Salvador or Ghana, or when I travel to these countries before I even knew what Bitcoin was, it was always with a deep sense of curiosity. What will actually help? What I've noticed more than anything is presence. You know, it's like presence, meaning not with a TS, but with a CE. Be present to people, you know, see where you can help. Try to stay connected to people, even if the internet isn't good, yeah. even if the situation isn't great, even if the people you're maybe trying to teach or trying to share information with, even if their cognitive framework is not as developed as you would like it to be, still don't stop. Continue to nurture those relationships. That's hard, though, and that's not romantic. So I think that, you know, these are some of the realities on the ground, you know, based on what I've seen. So I'll stop rambling there. I just figured, please feel free to contribute anything there if anything resonated with you or any thoughts.
So I just wanted to add based on the point. I think the whole thing, what's happening about the way the world looks at Africa and the way the world they look at Bitcoin, knowledge transferability and stuff like that, you have to do a lot with perspective and perception, right? So my perception about the world is different from perspective. Perspective is more like the reality, right? So perspective is what everybody else thinks. Perception is what I think vis-a-vis the people in front of me. So sometimes for us to make the world a better place, I need to come out of my perception and get into perspective in order to understand what is going on so that I can better push things forward for positive change, right? And then the other person needs to do the same. So if we all can find a common ground and say, okay, I'm out of my perception. This is our new reality. This is a new perspective that we need to pursue. I think we'll create a better world, not just for talking about Bitcoin, but generally. Just extrapolating things like generally.
100%. Yeah. But I think much like the point you made earlier about people feeling uncomfortable with certain information, I think people feel very uncomfortable. Given that that's the case, people, I think, hold on to their worldview and, as you said, their perception as a shield. You know, I think people use that as a shield.
Exactly.
It's hard to let your shield down, especially if you're speaking with someone who's from a different culture than you and you don't understand them as well. It's a very difficult process. My only recommendation to people would be, you don't have to drop your shield 100%. Just try dropping it 15%. Just try letting somebody else sort of share their worldview and let that affect, you know, let that either alter your perception or give you a little bit more perspective outside of your own sort of mind.
And to think about that a bit further, the world now is a global village, right? So unlike maybe like 20, 25, 30 years ago, there was really like this limit of knowledge, where knowledge can stay and then where knowledge can go, right? So with my laptop and the internet, I could access the same information a kid or a young person like me in New York, in Japan, wherever around the world is accessing at the same time. And we, depends on how much what we are looking at in terms of our own perception, right? So the perception always sets in. And for us to like initiate global conversations that will bring global change, we need to go out of our perception to create perspectives that will help all of us. So like that's why I really love the African Bitcoin Conference, because it helps everybody come out of their perception and find that particular perspective that all of us can work on.
And if I could add to that, if you do, let's say you're listening to this podcast and something that we're saying resonates, and you say to yourself, you know what, next year I'm going to go to the African Bitcoin Conference, or next year I'm going to go to Adopting Bitcoin in El Salvador, I'm going to recommend one thing. The conference itself will feel like a high. You'll feel pumped up. You'll feel like Bitcoin has already saved the world and everything is great and blah, 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 because people are in good spirits. People at these conferences tend to be optimists. I think most of us believe that Bitcoin is a form of hope. So you have a lot of hopeful, optimistic people, very bright people, very, very smart people. My suggestion to you would be spend at least one day going somewhere where you're uncomfortable. Don't stay in a 5-star hotel there. Maybe stay in an Airbnb in a local place. Just get a little bit of the feel for what the actual situation on the ground is. You don't have to go and orange pill anyone. You don't have to go and whatever. Just feel it, because it will be a bit different than what you experienced at the conference. That would be my only suggestion to people, because it's especially in the wake of a conference, it's very sobering. And I think it's important to, one, come back with the optimism from the conference and that good energy, but two, to come back with a sense of a reality that is maybe a little bit different than that of what was painted at the conference in some ways, or just experienced emotionally at the conference. Really, really important to sort of see what things look like on the ground. I want to touch on something on the back of your book. This is a little bit more high level, but I like that you mentioned it. I'm actually reading a book right now after listening to KG from Machan Kora speak and having a long conversation with him at the place we were together that night. Where was it? The One Corner Garden. I've been reading Mises, Human Action. So yeah, ooh. And this is this is like 1,000 pages of like deep stuff. One of the human action, the word for this, the fancy word for it, is praxeology. You actually mentioned on the back of your book that you're either a student or a fan, a believer in praxeology. I really like trying to introduce new terms and ways of thinking to people on this podcast. So could you give us a bit of an overview on what praxeology is and why you're a supporter of this philosophy or this way of thinking about the world?
Yeah, so I give like a personal definition of what what I learned about it. So for me, it's about understanding how your actions, what you say, what you do, how you move, interrelates with everything around you, and it forms like a bigger chunk and a much more bigger chunk and a much more bigger chunk that forms a world that has a lot of trouble. So for every idea, for every action taken, for everything, there was some small molecule that grew bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So the more conscious you are of the actions you take vis-a-vis the environment can be anything, your house, your kids, your car, anything. Maybe I'm getting up today, I want to put petrol in my car. The money you're using to put fuel in your car is going to help somebody feed that day. And then that money can help somebody take somebody to the hospital. The further you can think about the chain of how you as a single entity, no matter how small you are, you can affect the whole spectrum of the economy, makes you feel more conscious and makes you feel more guided about what you can do and what you cannot do, right? So look at what's happening in Palestine and Gaza and all that stuff, right? It starts from that small thing that we all misunderstood, that we all weren't conscious of, that we allow our human greed to take over, and then it has extrapolated to something that we cannot fix, and then all of us are just crying and then looking at the misery and like, oh, this is so deplorable, right? I believe that if all of us can help, can think about things as small molecules and then being conscious and being present, right? So even though praxeology talks about more of economic kind of things, like the exchanges, the services and stuff, how the little services you do, how the little things you create can create like bigger impacts and then have like a far-reaching effect. I think it goes beyond that. It goes like your morality. Like if you want to say shut up to somebody, you need to be conscious of how that is going to affect them. You just need to think about your anger and how you feel at the present time and stuff like that. So Patrology, more than just an economical term, is much more like a watchword and a philosophical word for me that means a lot.
That's beautifully put. I think that's really well put. And I think sometimes when people talk about, you know, some of these terms that come out of the Austrian economic school of thought, I think sometimes that school of thought tends to feel a little bit cold to people, like it's just cold, hard, calculated economic thought, but it's really not. There are some beautiful lessons about human nature in there. And I think if anything, it just makes us a little bit more conscious about, like you said, the words we use and everything from the words we use to the way money is spent at the highest levels. You know, it's a matter of that consciousness. Yeah, absolutely. Before we began speaking, or we tried to do this yesterday, you mentioned you wanted to talk obviously about Bitcoin in Africa. So I just wanted to open the floor up. If there was any sort of, you know, I know you've talked a little bit about it already, but any sort of extra perspective or things people should be either watching for, mindful of if they do come to visit, or if they are interested in helping, actually giving some of their time, presence to work with people or to support people and the work they're doing on the ground, what would you recommend to people?
Yep. So I think the first thing that like maybe two or three things that comes to mind straight away. First thing is, you know, in Africa we have like two major languages, and then I know there's Arabic, but when it comes to French and English, the English part of Africa seem to like have picked up the technology and then they're doing like lots of stuff. Yeah. But what is ironical is that the organization behind Afro Bitcoin are from Togo, Congo, I think, those two countries, right? But when you see the majority of the people that attend these conferences are English speaking.
Yep.
Right. So, and I've worked with Pax School for Francophone Africa. I'm seeing this gap. There's like a huge disparity, right? And there are these young guys from Benin. I don't know if you met them at the conference.
I met at least one person who's sort of a bigger figure there. Yes.
So they are doing like lots of work. And I just wonder that there are guys from Benin, there are guys from Congo, I guess from Cote d'Ivoire, they are doing like lots of work. They already understand the ethos of Bitcoin and how it's going to be transformational to them and stuff like that. And some of them can also speak English. So I'll maybe recommend maybe one or two of them to come on your podcast. So me, I can like really speak English because I'm from a country that speaks French and English. So I want to have like a mix of somebody who just speaks like who is French native but tries to express themselves in English. They really do speak good English as well, so you can have a really good conversation just for you to have that real typical French perspective of Bitcoin in Africa.
Please, and I would imagine that some of that disconnect has to do with the fact that oftentimes more educational materials are available, at least around Bitcoin, in English than they are in French. That would be my thought. But
it could be that, but it's more than that. So the main reason goes back to the policy of assimilation. Remember I told you assimilation takes you away from yourself, right? So now it seems like they've given you back yourself, but you haven't become to the full conscious level that you have yourself. So it's difficult if I bring other additional information around you, it'd be hard for you to assimilate that information, except you see like the train is already going, like moving really, really fast, right? There's that problem of assimilation as well. And right now, most of the people living in French African countries feel like, first, technology is something a bit complex to understand. Even though it's changing, but at first that was it. You speak to somebody who speaks English, they'll pick technology like really fast. Yeah, it's true because the language originally is English.
Yep.
You know, so like I was saying, most of them feel like technology is not their thing. Like, naturally, it doesn't come. And then now Bitcoin has added to it. And then there's still, I feel like there's a lot of gap So if you like organize in Cameroon, for example, if I organize a meetup, I'm living in Douala. Douala is a typically French-speaking town in Cameroon. But when I organize a meetup, I still meet a lot of people speaking English than French people.
Yep.
Meanwhile, you do the communication both in English and French, right?
Yep.
So there's that disparity that I just want to make, like, medias like us, podcasts like you, if we can bring like a few French people this year.
Of course. Just shoot
anytime,
shoot me a DM, even if just comes to mind, we'll get that going for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
To people listening, some people have reached out to me and asked to be guests, and I will surely do it. Sometimes it takes a little time because I have a long list of people that have either requested or I've already spoken with to be guests. But what I'm looking to do, and this is a good opportunity to say this, I'm not super concerned about how big this podcast gets or what it is. What I'd really, really like to do, and I want to stay true to the aim, is to bring voices into the space that are not really heard of. Obviously, I hope more and more people listen, so more and more people hear those voices. But, you know, if people have ideas or they feel that they're not being heard or that they've never been on a podcast, you are welcome to reach out. I can't always get you in immediately, but I would like to try to elevate and bring, you know, you just bring into the conversation as many voices as possible. So just taking that as a quick opportunity there to sort of extend what Sonda's saying. Is there anything else you wanted to share that maybe I didn't ask a question related to?
Yeah, now generally in Africa, it's just to have like different things that will make people be interested in Bitcoin.
Yep.
Right. So as much kind of education, as much support programs that we can have. And one thing that I want to stress on is that most African Bitcoiners, I think they pretty much have the same reality like me. So we doing Bitcoin education on a social budget, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And Bitcoin education is something that it's time consuming. You need to put effort. You need to put your mind, your energy, and stuff. And you know, the reward for it is not something that converts to something that will make you reach a certain level financially,
totally.
Right? We doing it completely out of passion,
yeah.
Right? And it's not like we are looking for maybe some people to be giving out money and stuff like that. But the thing is, I want most people like listening to this podcast to understand that most like 80% of all the Bitcoin kind of resources, educational initiative from Africa was done out of shoestring budget and out of like pure passion that I get this thing and then I want to do this, right?
Yep.
So people should be more conscious. So when you're talking to this person, you see the quality of their work.
Yeah.
You shouldn't like feel like you get up on.
Yes, 100%.
So you judge the quality of their work based on the availability of the resources that they have. Because I feel like I was lucky enough to produce something of good standard because I was working somewhere and I used my earnings from that place where I was working to produce what I was producing. Even though at one point the money wasn't coming in because I was laid off. But yeah, not everybody gets that. Some people want to do stuff, but they don't have the resources.
Yep.
So they have to do what they can. And it comes out the way it comes out. And I just want more people that are looking at things that are happening in Africa with the more like out of perception eye, like I mentioned, to look at it from a perspective level.
And I could,
so this to be
from the very little experience I have there when I went out to Bitcoin Dua to Agbozume in Ghana the day.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I saw how little resources they're working with. But also what I've realized is what they were asked, not one person there asked me for Bitcoin. Not one person said, can I Bitcoin? What a lot of them asked was like, could you share your knowledge with me or could you just help bring attention to what we're doing? And so to people out there also, before when I said, you know, your presence is valuable, P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E, it's valuable because I think sometimes people go down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, they don't realize how much they've learned and how much other people don't necessarily understand. So sometimes you sharing information that you might think is sort of common knowledge, it's not. You know, it's not like, I'll parallel this to one thing. If you've ever done something like made a big change in your life, for me, I stopped drinking it 6 years ago. I don't drink anymore. And when I made that decision, I had this weird feeling in my head, or, you know, this thought of like, oh, everybody else has made that decision too. And now everybody else has stopped drinking. It's similar to understanding Bitcoin. You just sort of think that everybody else around the world has also gone on this journey already and they get it. It's not the case. So when you share even very basic things with people, like for example, I was just showing the team in Bitcoin Dua how to earn money through microlancer.io. So ways that they could earn Bitcoin through, you know, doing small things on the internet, small amounts of Bitcoin, but that way they don't have to spend their hard earned money. They don't have to get into setting up a Binance account or a Bitnob account, or you know, they could just earn it and whatever. These things can all go a long way because whoever you teach, my background is a teacher, they're going to teach other people. So don't think that what you're doing isn't enough, and do the best you can to elevate people in the space who might not have the amount of resources you have. I think that that's really important. And that could be as simple as retweeting something, sharing some thoughts. Exactly. You know what I mean? There's ways to elevate voices. And these are very light lifts. These are not heavy lifts that we're talking about here. So just keep that in mind, especially if you see new voices in the space that are contributing something important, beautiful, some new perspective. Try to elevate those voices. We all love Jeff Booth and we all love Saifedean Ammous, but like, And I hope that they continue to have immense success, but we do really need to bring more people into the space and elevate more voices because there's a lot of realities on the ground in places that people have really very little consciousness of. So,
yeah. So just to add about what you're saying, I have a Bitcoiner friend in the US who gave one of my books to Saifedean Ammous, right? I don't know if you've seen that.
He tweeted before. It. Yeah, he tweeted. Yeah.
Yes. So I want to tell you the ripple effect of that. Just one single tweet. Mm-hmm. So he gave him the book, and then he gave him the book during the Bitcoin Miami. And then I don't know what happened. I didn't text Saifedean or anything like that. Yeah. And then one Sunday morning, I just saw a tweet from Saifedean Ammous, and I was tagged on it. I'm like, is this the fake one or the real one?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And when I opened it, I'm like, wow. He said his kids had read the book, and then the kids liked the book, and then he's encouraging people to buy the book.
Yep.
And I think I've never sold so many books in one day.
That's great to hear. Yes. That's amazing.
Yeah. So I sold almost like 150 copies.
Wow.
like just digital copy that day, and then like the following day, like maybe just some of up to like 200.
That's
right?
Amazing.
And then other people now started following me, started paying attention to what I was doing, and I met most of these people in Ghana. So imagine like maybe some of these like top Bitcoiners, they look at like the Bitcoiners that are doing this stuff. You don't need to give anybody money.
Yep.
Just take what they are doing, expose
that's
their
right.
work, right?
That's right.
That's the biggest thing I need from everyone. Like when you get the book, you review it, you critique it. Or I think maybe in the book, maybe in this chapter, I could have added this and stuff. I like this aspect. I think you should improve on it. That's good.
Yep.
That's good money for me because I know other people are going to come and see it, and then they'll be interested in what I'm
yep.
doing. And it keeps going my network.
Yeah.
So I think everybody who is building something, Bitcoin Dada, Master Guantai, Kogetso, Kumi, all of us need somebody to just come and say, hey, I want to show your work to the world. That's it.
Yep.
Put it on their status, put it on their Twitter feed and stuff like that. Yeah.
100%. And yeah, it doesn't mean don't give money either. If you want to donate money as well. But
exactly.
Yeah, do what feels right in your heart.
But the most important thing is not money. The most important thing is not money. It's just about being genuinely supportive of somebody else's work. Like,
100%.
Look at the work and give your feedback based on your experience. That's going to help them. It's like you're teaching them how to fish, not giving them
that's
fish.
Right. 100%. I think that's actually a beautiful place to leave it off for today. Lately, I don't know what it is. I get as high having these conversations for the podcast as I did meeting people in person, but I always leave it off saying, I know that we're going to have this conversation again. I generally have this feeling of like I'm meeting such amazing people like yourself that I have this feeling. I woke up the other day and I was like, I'm so glad I get to live the rest of my life with this community. I'm so glad that this community will be there for the rest of my life, God willing, obviously, but like, you know, it's such an exciting time. Yeah, I just love having these conversations. I hope that what Zonda's sharing today resonates with you. If it is, obviously go get yourself a copy of Bitcoin Kids. On that note, tell them where they can do so. Please let them know where they can both find that, and then tell them where they can find you online as well.
Yep. So to get the book, it's easy. You can buy the book on the website. It's on my Twitter bio with Lightning. You just pay with Lightning, and you have it in copy. And if you want the physical copy, you can just DM me as well on Twitter, and then we figure it out. Because I've been having troubles putting the book on Amazon. So it's a challenge, but it gives me more flexibility on how and control on how I sell the book and stuff like that. Okay. Yeah, so and just to add, we have like two compartments that we're working on. So we've been able to distribute about like 600 copies of the book for free, nice. Even though we're selling from. So because we know that it's not just about selling, you know, everybody will be willing to buy the book. So we've had like outreach programs in Bitcoin Dwell, in Uganda, in Nigeria, and I think Kenya as well, where we just give out books for free and stuff like that. So if people are interested, maybe you look at the book and then you say, oh, this thing is Bitcoin, you can donate. And then on Geza, the project is on Geza, you can donate maybe directly to me or something like that. And then, that's basically, and my Twitter is at Bitcoin Sophist. Yeah. Perfect. So,
and just a quick thing, he mentioned it. People pronounce this word differently. Every time I speak with someone, he mentioned it's at Geyser. In the way I would say it as a New Yorker would be Geyser. So it's short for Geyser Fund.
Yeah, Geyser.
So if you Google Geyser Fund, and then what would be like the other keyword that they should type in? Geyser Fund and Bitcoin Kids or something like that?
Yes, Geyser Fund.
That's a way you could pay for this in sats. Geyser Fund is a great crowdsourcing platform for sats. The best one out there. So. I think you walked up to me at the conference and introduced yourself. I very much appreciate your having done so. Very, very happy to be in touch with you. Please, as you said, if you have some other people I should be speaking with, please feel free to pass their information along. In the meantime, I hope everybody goes out, buys the book, follows Zonda online. And more than anything, I hope you're feeling good and that you're better off having absorbed some of Zonda's wisdom here. So I'm going to leave it at that. Any last words or anything you'd like to share?
I just want Bitcoiners to be more realistic. Bitcoin is something that is going to change the world, definitely, but it's not going to solve every problem that the world has. Yeah. That's
a good closing thought. All right, everybody. Thank you guys so much for listening. We will be back soon, and take it easy. We'll talk soon.